Content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Fred Woodward for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the Week magazine. Today, we're reading from the December 8th, 2023 issue of the Week. Our cover drawing this week has a superhero version of Sam Altman. He's the recently fired and then rehired CEO of a company called OpenAI. He's got on a tight purple outfit, a big AI emblem on his chest. He's got a red cape, and he's just broken out of these chains. He's flying, his eyes are glowing red, and there's a starry night sky in the background. The headline is OpenAI Unbound: How Altman's Return as CEO Could Boost the Promise and Perils of Artificial Intelligence. And we get that story with the controversy of the week, but we'll start with the first main story. Israeli hostages return home amid Gaza truce. What happened? Dozens of Israeli hostages seized by Hamas during its October 7th attack were released this week as part of a Gaza ceasefire deal, a truce that international negotiators were racing to extend in the first 6 days of the Egypt-Qatar-mediated ceasefire. Hamas freed about 100 hostages, most of them Israeli women and children. Israel released some 200 Palestinian prisoners, all women and minors, and allowed expanded humanitarian aid into Hamas-run Gaza. Cheering crowds greeted the hostages as they arrived back in Israel. Among those released was Abigail Idan, a 4-year-old American-Israeli girl whose parents were killed in front of her. "What she endured is unthinkable," said President Biden. As the ceasefire neared an end, both sides expressed interest in a longer truce, with a continued exchange at a ratio of 3 Palestinians for each Hamas hostage. CIA Director William J. Burns flew to Qatar to help broker a deal for the release of all Israelis held in Gaza. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said he was open to a deal, but insisted Israel's campaign to wipe out Hamas would eventually continue. Israel, he said, is fighting until the end. Hundreds of trucks and 3 U.S. military planes brought food, water, medical supplies, and fuel to Gaza, where the Hamas-run health authority says Israel has killed more than 13,000 Palestinians and left hundreds of thousands homeless. Aid workers reported people scrambling for bread, burning garbage for fuel, and trying to clean non-potable water by straining it through their clothes. Gaza's 2 million residents have lost everything, said UN Relief Agency spokeswoman Juliette Tuma, and they need everything. What the editorial said: "At last, some hopeful news from Gaza," said the Financial Times. "After weeks of death and devastation, it's heartening to see hostages return home and relief brought to desperate Palestinians. This diplomatic breakthrough must not be wasted. The ceasefire must continue until all of the original 240 hostages are released, and Israel should use the pause to refine its objective and shift away from its maximalist rhetoric. If it continues down its current path, Israel will reduce Gaza to a wasteland where the roots of the next crisis will inevitably start to take hold. Joy over the homecomings shouldn't blind us to how Hamas is manipulating human sentiment to achieve its terrorist aims," said the Wall Street Journal. Each day Hamas draws out the truce is another day it can spend regrouping and planning more atrocities. With Hamas unlikely to release all of the hostages, its only source of leverage, eventually the onus will fall on Israel to end the truce. It's a terrible choice that Hamas doesn't have to make because it considers civilians, including Palestinians, to be expendable weapons of war. What the columnist said. While the released hostages have remained cloistered, details about their confinement have trickled out, said Julia Frankel in the Associated Press. Most appeared to be stable physical condition, but the psychological toll will be steep. A nephew of Adina Moshe, 72, said his aunt had to adjust to sunlight after being freed because she was kept in complete darkness for a week. Rudy Munder, 78, said she was kept in a dark, suffocating room with other hostages and slept on plastic chairs. It was very difficult, she said. The truce is a win for both sides for now, said Patrick Kingsley in the New York Times. But the longer it continues, the greater Israel's conundrum. Hamas popularity is surging in the Israeli-occupied West Bank, home to many of the Palestinian prisoners released from Israeli prisons. And as the pause in hostilities goes on, Israel will face intensifying international pressure to halt its offensive entirely. Meanwhile, Netanyahu is being squeezed at home between Israelis who want to bring home the rest of the hostages and far-right members of his government who want to resume fighting and crush Hamas. The ceasefire could last a while, said David Ignatius in the Washington Post. A source close to the negotiations tells me both sides have interest in a broad deal to free all Israeli captives in exchange for a longer pause and the release of more Palestinian prisoners. If that happens, the end game will be the trickiest issue of all. Hostage negotiations have defied expectations so far, and a permanent ceasefire can't be ruled out. But it's not likely. Barring such a deal, Israel will face a knotty challenge: how to finish the job it started without triggering renewed international outrage. And the controversy of the week. OpenAI on the verge of a dangerous breakthrough. The news that a mild-mannered tech exec has the same job he had 2 weeks earlier is not usually greeted as an existential risk to humanity, said Peter Guest and Morgan Meeker in Wired. Nevertheless, here we are. The board of OpenAI, the hot artificial intelligence startup behind the ChatGPT chatbot, last week rehired Sam Altman as CEO just 4 days after it abruptly fired him for concerns about his candor. The not-for-profit board's dramatic change of heart, all but one board member also resigned, followed a threat by more than 700 of OpenAI's 770 employees to quit and join Altman at a new group he set up within Microsoft. It remains unclear why he was fired in the first place, said Charlie Wartzel in The Atlantic. But for the past year, there has been a widening rift at OpenAI. On one side are the accelerationists, like Altman, who want to speed ahead with developing and commercializing generative AI systems. On the other hand, the doomers, including many ex-members of the board, who worry about AI's potential to cause catastrophic harm, everything from mass unemployment to the birth of an all-powerful artificial general intelligence, AGI, that might snuff out humankind on a whim. If the rumors are true that the board fired Altman after it learned of a secret AGI breakthrough in a secret project known as Q-Star, then his triumphant return, more powerful than before, could have far-reaching implications. Let's dial down the hysteria, said Andrew Stuttiford in National Review. OpenAI's employees would not have rallied behind Altman if they thought his return, or AI itself, might bring about the end of the world. Most of them, like Altman, believe they're working on technology that could revolutionize drug development, cure aging, and fuel clean energy development. Are there risks? Of course. But the more quickly we develop AI, the more we will know about what can go wrong and how to fix it. As for Q-Star, said Kyle Wiggers in TechCrunch, insiders say it's just an AI model with a flair for solving relatively simple math equations. It's not, they insist, a godlike AGI about to spell doom for humanity. But when we're talking about a field of research that's up there with the atom bomb in its destructive potential, said Jill Filipovich in CNN.com, how can we take anything on trust? The chaos at OpenAI has highlighted the insanity of leaving AI's safe development to a handful of secretive feuding tech execs, especially when many of those bigwigs, including Altman, acutely understand just how quickly these machines could develop the capacity to annihilate us. Altman's home is a prepper's paradise, loaded with guns, antibiotics, water, batteries, and gas masks from the Israeli Defense Forces, according to the New Yorker. Stiff regulations and compulsory transparency are urgently needed to rein in unaccountable AI researchers. What if it's too late, asked Ezra Klein in the New York Times. The Biden administration has been impressively proactive in AI regulation, laying out a sprawling, thoughtful framework of principles that would let watchdogs monitor advances in AI, intervening if necessary. But those guardrails will work only if AI develops in the same incremental fashion as most technologies. If instead its abilities rise exponentially, it's unlikely regulators could act in time to shut the systems down. We're likely already past that point, said Megan McArdle in the Washington Post. What Altman and his team have built is like a digital bobsled, hurtling either toward utopia or catastrophe. Like it or not, we're all going with them. It's our good week, bad week piece. It's a good week for fishy business. After it was reported that jailed FTX founder Sam Bankman-Fried has been trading pouches of mackerel fillets for haircuts and other services behind bars. Sam's doing the best he can under the circumstances, said spokesman Mark Botnick. It was a good week for rubbernecking. After Pluto TV debuted a 24-hour car chase channel that blends footage of past chases with live coverage of real-time pursuits. Data and research, said a Pluto spokesperson, show that car chases have been of huge interest to audiences for many years. It was a good week for chip tech. After Doritos released Doritos Silent, an AI-powered app that removes the sound of crunching potato chips from online voice chats, Zoom, or any calls that use headphones. I think it's going to have an impact, said lead developer Dylan Fashbaugh. But it was a bad week for privilege. After Indianapolis Colts owner Jim Irsay blamed his 2014 drunk driving arrest on racial and economic profiling. I am prejudiced against because I'm a rich white billionaire, said Irsay, 64. If I'm just the average guy down the block, they're not pulling me in. It was a bad week for national security after a group of self-described gay furry hackers breached the systems of Idaho National Laboratory, one of the nation's largest nuclear labs, and threatened to release employee data unless researchers start work on creating real-life mutant cat girls. Finally, it was a bad week for detours. After Google Maps routed dozens of drivers heading from Nevada to Southern California off the interstate, onto a dirt trail, and deep into the desert. Turning around, said driver Shelby Easler, required like a 7-point turn into one bush, and then another bush, and then a rock, and then a cactus. The briefing this week has the title, What Space Does to the Body. Humans are preparing to venture deeper into space. Scientists aren't sure if our bodies are up to the challenge. What missions are in the works? SpaceX and Tesla boss Elon Musk has said he wants to put 1 million people on Mars by 2050, while Amazon and Blue Origin founder Jeff Bezos dreams of trillions living permanently on floating space colonies in coming centuries. Perhaps more realistically, NASA is planning to build houses on the moon by 2040, inhabited by astronauts and ordinary civilians, and then to construct colonies on Mars. But beyond the engineering challenges of rocketing humans to those far-flung locales, a one-way trip to the Red Planet would take at least 9 months. Researchers are also grappling with the huge health problems posed by living in space or on other planets for long periods of time. Our bodies evolved on a world where there is constant and plentiful gravity and relatively low background radiation. But in space, those conditions are flipped. Without massive scientific advances, humans may never be able to colonize these ultra-hostile environments. Space is just not very hospitable to the human body, said Emmanuel Urquieta, chief medical officer at Translational Research Institute for Space Health in Houston. How does low gravity affect humans? First, it makes you want to puke. Much like motion sickness on Earth, space adaptation syndrome stems from a mismatch between what the eyes see and what the inner ear tells your brain. But unlike on Earth, that mismatch results from the organs and vestibular system operating without their usual gravitational signals. Those feelings of queasiness eventually dissipate, but other bodily problems remain. Without Earth's gravitational pull, urine doesn't pool at the base of the bladder, but rather around the organ's walls. Because spacegoers don't necessarily feel the pressure associated with a full bladder, one academic paper notes, urination may happen suddenly and spontaneously. Some astronauts fit themselves with catheters because their bladders won't empty at all. Low gravity also takes a toll on astronauts' bones and muscles. What happens? Floating around in low gravity is a lot like lying around doing nothing, says NASA scientist Michael Stinger. Without the need to support the body's weight, muscles atrophy and bones lose density. Research shows that for otherwise healthy astronauts, bone density in the hips and spine decreases by 1 to 2% a month in space. Among elderly people on Earth, it can drop 0.5 to 1% a year. By exercising for more than two hours a day, space travelers can limit muscle and bone loss, but not shrinkage of the heart, which doesn't have to pump as hard in space. When astronaut Scott Kelly returned to Terra Firma in 2016, after nearly a year on the International Space Station, his heart had diminished in size by nearly a third and become rounder. His eyeballs, meanwhile, had become less spherical. That shrinkage didn't result in negative health effects for Scott, but researchers wonder whether weaker hearts might cause explorers to become lightheaded when they walk around Mars after a months-long space journey. With a spinning space station or spacecraft, it might be possible to create artificial gravity, easing some of those health worries. What about cosmic radiation? Earth's magnetic field shields the relatively close ISS and other near-orbit missions from the most damaging solar and galactic radiation. But missions to the Moon and Mars won't have that protection. A 2016 study found that the 24 Apollo astronauts who flew beyond the reach of our planet's magnetosphere for no more than a week at a time were nearly five times more likely to die from cardiovascular disease than astronauts of the same era who never left Earth's orbit or who never flew at all. While the sample size is tiny, researchers suspect exposure to cosmic radiation damaged the Apollo astronauts' DNA, arteries, and veins, leaving them vulnerable to heart disease. NASA researchers say that a shield of water around a spaceship or Mars colony about 8 inches thick would absorb most space radiation, but water is dense and expensive to ferry from Earth. Some scientists have suggested tweaking space flyers' genomes with CRISPR technology to protect them against radiation-related health issues. You can't dismiss it as an idea, but right now we don't know the mechanisms, NASA Radiation Health Officer Edward Simone said of the radical plan. Will crew members face psychological challenges? Humans are social creatures, and so the isolation, homesickness, and interpersonal drama experienced during a months or years long mission will have an impact on astronauts' minds. A joint Russian, European, and Chinese study from 2007 to 2011 simulated a 520-day mission to Mars with an all-male crew of six. It found that as the subjects experienced less contact with other humans because of the distances, there is an average communication delay of 13 minutes between Earth and any Mars mission, and were denied images from home, they suffered detachment phenomena. The crew increasingly saw mission control as redundant and started to resist instruction. To see how humans might cope on Mars, four NASA crew members in June began a year-long stay at a 3D-printed habitat in Houston. If we get to the end of the year and the crew is complete, said Mission Commander Kelly Haston, that would be, for me, a huge thing. Despite mounting evidence of the massive health and psychological risks of deep space exploration, there is no shortage of candidates willing to sign up for such missions. I'd go in a heartbeat, said space health expert Urquita. It's so inspiring. It's space. Moving into the best columns of the week, we'll start with two from the U.S. this week. First up, a senile presidential candidate. President Biden had good reason for a low-key celebration of his 81st birthday last week, said David A. Graham. Roughly three-quarters of voters believe Biden, with his stiff gait, frequent gaffes, and halting speech, is too old for a second term. But the likely Republican challenger, the 77-year-old Donald Trump, is actually showing even more alarming signs of decrepitude. Much of what Trump says these days is unintelligible, even for him. At rallies, he repeatedly mixes up the Biden and Obama administrations and said he beat Obama in an election that everyone said he could have won, said couldn't be won. He also said he beat Bush, the leader who got us into the Middle East, confusing Jeb with George W. In another speech, Trump praised North Korea's Kim Jong-un, but said he leads 1.4 billion people, mixing him up with China's Xi Jinping. Trump's loss of mental acuity is blazingly obvious, so why doesn't it get more attention? His loud bluster makes him sound vigorous, and his nest of dyed hair and heavy orange makeup make him look less old than the wan Biden. But if old age is an issue for presidential contenders in 2024, it should be an issue for both. When kids are shaped by screens, a generation of kids had screens shoved in their faces since birth, said Eloise Hindy, and they're growing up defined and utterly subsumed by the digital world. American kids born since 2010 have only known a world dominated by handheld screens. By 2017, a study found 80% of children had access to a tablet. I know of one two-year-old girl who, upon seeing a real butterfly outside her window, made finger movements to zoom in on it. This digital dependence, child development experts say, is not healthy. Using screens as pacifiers denies toddlers the opportunity to learn how to cope with boredom, frustration, and other difficult feelings. Excessive screen time also interferes with the development of eyesight, spatial awareness, and motor skills. iPad kids have become a different species, adept at navigating the digital world, but hopeless at impulse control. They are prone to angry demands and tantrums. I truly sympathize with the stressed-out, exhausted parents who find a colorful video or game is the only way to keep kids quiet in a car or restaurant. But do we really want to risk letting screens transform our kids into a fleet of clumsy, myopic tyrants? This column comes from South Africa. We protest for Gaza, but not for ourselves. South Africans are desperate and frightened, said Imram Bukas. So why aren't they protesting in the streets? The country is in a downward spiral, with household incomes dropping 8 of the last 12 years. The poor suffer endemic unemployment and hunger, while the middle classes go into debt just to send their kids to school. And everyone lives in fear of the increasingly brazen and violent crime. In a chilling new kidnapping trend, men dressed as police have been mugging people and forcing them to empty their accounts using the banking apps on their phones. That the country is in such a state is the fault of the African National Congress Party, which has governed ever since Nelson Mandela won the first post-apartheid election in 1994. In the decades since that first heady victory, the ANC has collapsed into a violent and corrupt organization controlled by avaricious people with no concern for society. South Africans do still know how to protest. Just 2 weeks ago, tens of thousands turned out in Cape Town to condemn Israel's massacre of Gazans. That shows that some of the legacy of the mass organization of the 1980s remains. The trick now is to channel that righteous anger into opposition to our own government's many failings. Time for the last word, our in-depth article. This topic may be of particular interest to our audience. Blind courage. Elaine Oidvin was used to running marathons without the benefit of sight, said Jack Dolan in the Los Angeles Times. So she set herself a new challenge, climbing a 14,000-foot mountain. As Elaine Oidvin approached the top of Mount Langley, a 14,000-foot colossus in California's eastern Sierra Nevada, she could feel the soft sandy gravel beneath her feet. She could hear the enveloping silence of the barren landscape. But she couldn't see a thing. Not the craggy summit looking over the Owens Valley 10,000 feet below, or the nearly vertical 700-foot drop that menaced just a few steps to the right. Oidvin, who was born almost completely blind, would tell me later she was terrified as she matched strides with her guide, Therese Norbo, keeping the lightest of grasp on Norbo's elbow. Oidvin concentrated on her own breath so she wouldn't panic or start hyperventilating. But she was also thrilled to be on the brink of an accomplishment that previous generations might have regarded as impossible. I was just trying to keep calm, telling myself, "You can do this," Oidvin said. At 46, Oidvin, a standout marathoner, was attempting her first serious mountain climb and doing it on one of California's highest peaks. A mutual friend and longtime climbing buddy, we had climbed Mount Kilimanjaro and Mount Whitney together, had asked me to join the small group she would trust to guide her safely up and back. The idea seemed crazy to me at first. I understood that Oidvin was extremely fit, but I had never met her. I also knew that running on paved streets is one thing. Climbing mountains, navigating over boulders, around downed trees, and across cold streams is entirely different. Still, I'd been too curious to say no. And as we approached the summit beneath a brilliant blue September sky, I had to temper my own mix of exhaustion, anxiety, and awe at what she was about to accomplish. Oidvin is among a growing number of outdoor adventure athletes who refuse to let disabilities reduce them to spectators. In recent years, blind athletes have run astonishingly fast marathons, scaled the towering sheer rock face of Yosemite's El Capitan, and climbed the seven summits, the highest peaks on each continent. Eric Weyenmeyer, 55, was the first blind person to reach the summit of Everest. His love of the outdoors began after a hereditary retina disease left him blind a week before his freshman year of high school. It happened at an age when you want so much to be a part of the gang. You want so much to be cool, Weyenmeyer said. And there I was being led in my mobility instructor. I had to hold her elbow and let her lead me to class, to the bathroom. He remembers sitting alone in the cafeteria of his Connecticut high school because even former friends didn't know how to act around him. The thought of never being in the thick of things and always being shoved to the sidelines and having a life of no adventure, no excitement, that was terrifying to me, he said. Since Weyenmeyer couldn't play ball sports, his dad signed him up with a group that took visually impaired people horseback riding, sailing, and one fateful weekend, rock climbing. As soon as he got on the wall and he ran his hands and feet over the holds, like reading Braille with his fingertips, he was hooked. It was absolute engagement, absolute physical, emotional, and spiritual connection with nature, and everything I wanted out of life, said Weinmeier, who now lives in Colorado. It took Oidvin a couple of decades longer to discover her inner adventurer, but when she finally did, the transformation was just as profound. Born in Korea and given up for adoption, she was taken in at the age of 3 months by a pair of school teachers who lived nearly 5,000 miles away in a remote village on the west coast of Norway. Her early efforts to fit in with the other kids to match their athletic exploits didn't go well. She's completely blind in her right eye and has just a sliver of peripheral vision in her left. It's like peeking through a keyhole, she said, and even then, she can only see things a few inches away. She signed up for soccer and handball at school, but was always running the wrong way and worried about getting hit by the ball, she said with a laugh. Her insistence that her parents buy her a bicycle ended in frustration and bruises. It wasn't the smartest thing, she admitted. I really wanted to be like the other kids, and I really tried, but I could never succeed, she said. So she set her sporting dreams aside and got on with life. College, marriage, kids. She was working as a physical therapist in the village where she grew up when, on a work trip to Oslo, she bumped into a group of fellow conference attendees in the hotel lobby who were heading out for a run. One of them, a doctor with experience guiding blind runners, insisted she come along. She was shy at first, didn't want to slow everybody else down, but they wouldn't take no for an answer. Some of the best things in life just happen by coincidence, Oidvin said. The run went well, and not long after, the doctor called to say an athlete he was supposed to guide in an upcoming half marathon had backed out. He asked Oidvin to join him. She had never run more than 4 or 5 miles at this point, and 13.1 miles would be a huge step up. Oidvin worried about making a fool of herself or wasting her new friend's time. Don't worry, he assured her. If we have to walk the last few miles, it's no big deal. Oidvin ran every step of that race and won her division. It was her first taste of athletic success and a watershed moment. It changed my life, Oidvin said. It completely changed how I thought about myself. Since then, she has traveled the globe, blowing away most of her visually impaired competition in 47 marathons, from New York to Athens to Barcelona. In 2015, she won her division in the Boston Marathon, one of the most celebrated and competitive races in the world. It hasn't always gone smoothly. At the Berlin Marathon, a race whose famously long straight boulevards have led to 13 world records, Oidvin was on pace to run the fastest marathon of her life. With about 6 miles left, her guide suffered a sudden bout of diarrhea and had to dash for the porta-potties. Abandoned and unable to continue by herself, there was nothing Oidvin could do but stand in the street as precious seconds and hordes of slower runners passed by. Her guide, guilt-stricken at the turn of events, abandoned modesty, kicked open the porta-potty door from the inside and begged in broken German for someone to help Oidvin. He was sitting there on the toilet with the door wide open, screaming, Oidvin recalled. It worked. A runner with guiding experience appeared out of the crowd, offered his elbow, and off they went. She finished in 3 hours and 33 minutes, a personal best despite the delay. That's just how it goes, Oidvin said. Being blind creates obstacles other athletes don't face, but it also brings out extraordinary grace and generosity in complete strangers. Oidvin's interest in the Sierra Nevada began when one of her most trusted marathon guides, Andy Lairn, who helped lead her to victory in Boston, told her about his climbs of Mount Whitney and hikes among the towering pine trees and soaring granite walls in Yosemite. Oidvin said she wanted to give mountaineering a try, and Lairn, a friend of mine for nearly 30 years, asked if I would assist. We assembled a team that included two friends from Seattle, both experienced mountaineers, and three Norwegians who have guided Oidvin in road races. We picked Mount Langley, the most accessible of the giant peaks, just west of Lone Pine, about 4 hours north of Los Angeles, because it's mostly a long hike on well-defined trail with only one brief section of mildly technical climbing. The day before starting up Langley, we did a short acclimatization hike from about 8,000 to 9,000 feet on the flanks of Mount Whitney. I had no idea how this was going to work until Oidvin placed her hand very lightly on my elbow and said, "Let's go." As we ascended the initial switchbacks, I noticed she stuck her toes a little farther out in front than most people do with each stride. It was a subtle and much more graceful version of what the rest of us might do with our hands while searching for the light switch in a dark, unfamiliar hotel room. At first, I warned her every time we approached a big step up or down, but it didn't take long to realize she could usually sense the size and direction of each step by reading my body language, the clues transmitted through her fingers resting on my arm. The speed and ease with which she made these calculations was astonishing. Before I met Oidvin, I wondered how we would get her down fast enough in an emergency. After our first hike together, I wondered how I would keep up if she started running. In addition to her remarkable ability to sense what was coming on the trail, she had an exceptional awareness of the landscape around us. She knew when trees were nearby, how tall they were, and whether they had leaves or pine needles. That's due to a kind of sonar, sometimes called echolocation, honed by some visually impaired people, especially those who have been blind since birth. Oidvin said a friend with two glass eyes can snap his fingers in a strange room and tell you not only where the windows are, but also how big they are. "It's not that I can hear better than you," she told me. "I just pay more attention." The only thing that really scared her about the climb was the possibility of altitude sickness. She had never been above a few thousand feet, and she was worried how her body would react. Headaches and nausea are common for newcomers to the high mountains. Along with bad weather, they're the most common reason people who are otherwise fit don't make it to the summit. That weight on her, especially in the spooky lunar landscape above 12,000 feet, where there are no bushes or trees, just low-lying boulders and endless gravel. Above 13,000 feet, the trail disappears, turning the final push into a steep, tortuous slog up loose scree guided only by cairns, stone towers left by previous climbers to mark the way. As we approached the summit and the vertigo-inducing cliff a few feet behind it, Oidvin couldn't see how steep and long the drop was. "Lucky me," she joked, but she knew it was there. "I could feel it, and I could hear the emptiness," she explained. She knew to be wary and to stick close to the rest of us. I think I had the same feeling you had. But she didn't let it stop her. Marathons had become sort of routine, she said, but climbing a 14,000-foot mountain was so wildly out of her comfort zone that it brought back the butterflies she felt in her stomach before that first half marathon more than a decade ago. She beamed as Nordbo guided her foot to the small, round metal disc embedded in the granite by the U.S. Geological Survey to mark the Mount Langley summit. "Life can be scary, but fear doesn't help," she told me later. "I've learned not to overthink these things." This story originally appeared in the Los Angeles Times. Read a couple of the short health and science pieces. How COVID keeps getting more infectious. 2 years after Omicron launched a vicious new wave of COVID cases, the virus's dominant variant remains astonishingly infectious and genetically agile. It is still mutating, reports the New York Times, and its descendants are becoming ever more adept at evading immune defenses. Over the past year, more than 80,000 Americans died of COVID, more than eight times the number that died from the flu. The variant's initial wave in the U.S., which started in December 2021, spread to almost half of all Americans within months, even those who had been vaccinated or who already had COVID. Omicron's mutations had altered the surface of the virus particles so that the antibodies those patients possessed couldn't stick to it. The variant killed a smaller fraction of those infected, but because it infected so many people, it had millions more chances to mutate again. And the same pattern repeats with the subvariants. It becomes like a laboratory for virus evolution, said Peter Markov, a virologist at the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine. Omicron's children are now evolving faster than vaccines can keep up. The latest booster, for example, targeted the XBB variant, which was already on the wane when the vaccine dropped this fall. A new, more resilient variant, JN1, has just emerged in France. Still, regular boosters are the best defense. Those who get them are dramatically less likely to be hospitalized or to develop long COVID. Global warming's scary milestone. November 17th was an unwelcome landmark in the fight against climate change, reports Time. It was the first day in human history when the average global temperature hit 2 degrees Celsius warmer than pre-industrial levels. The following day, that watershed moment was repeated. This doesn't mean we've officially breached the 2015 Paris Agreement, which committed the world to limiting temperature rise to well below 2 degrees, and ideally to 1.5 degrees. That goal is based on long-term temperature averages over several years. But it's not a good sign, particularly as this is not the only record to fall in recent months. Every month since June has set a new high temperature. The past 8 years have been the eight hottest on record, and 2023 is on track to break the 2016 record for hottest year ever. At this rate, the latest UN report says, Earth is speeding toward a 2.5 to 2.9 degrees Celsius of warming by the end of the century. It's really an indication that we are already seeing a change, an acceleration, said report lead author Anne Olhoff of Danish climate think tank CONCITO. Based on what science tells us, this is just like a whisper. What will be in the future will be more like a roar. And over on the Talking Points page, Gaza, what is Israel's endgame? Nearly 2 months into a war that's far from over, there is no clear post-war strategy in sight, said Nadine Ibrahim in CNN.com. Even as Israeli forces have tightened their grip on northern Gaza, Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu appears not to have a clear idea what will happen after Israel completes its effort to eradicate Hamas. President Biden and Secretary of State Antony Blinken have warned Israel against reoccupying Gaza and have stressed a future role there for the Palestinian Authority, which controls large parts of the West Bank. But experts question whether any Palestinians will be willing to work with Israel after a war that's reportedly killed more than 13,000 Palestinians, displaced two-thirds of the populace, and destroyed or damaged nearly 50% of the housing. The problems with the Palestinian Authority, the PA, run far deeper than that, said Stephen Erlanger in the New York Times. Its 88-year-old president, Mahmoud Abbas, has allowed no national election since his Fatah faction lost to Hamas in 2006, and the PA is deeply unpopular among Palestinians. It is widely seen as an authoritarian, corrupt, and undemocratic administration that has been propped up by Israel. Few believe it is capable of running a post-conflict Gaza. Another post-war scenario is for a peacekeeping force drawn from Arab countries to govern Gaza, said Joost Hilterman. But that's also unlikely. Arab neighbors are interested in stepping into an explosive conflict and trying to govern a notoriously unruly population, hardened by years of armed resistance to Israel. With no realistic alternative, Israel may decide to reoccupy Gaza and try to rule over its newly homeless, desperate, and very angry population. That would be disastrous, said Samai Nakhul in Reuters. If Israel stays in Gaza without offering any credible plan to move toward Palestinian self-rule, it will face a long and bloody insurgency like the ones faced by the U.S. in Iraq and Afghanistan. That's why the only viable path forward is the creation of a Palestinian state, said Roy Kibrick in The Guardian. Neither Israel nor the Palestinian Authority will take the initiative, so Biden must step up, commit to a two-state solution, set out a timeline, and get Arab countries and the United Nations on board. It's the only hope for a lasting peace in Gaza. Congress, why so many members are quitting? House members are running for the exits, said Kayla Gu in the New York Times. Disgusted with the dysfunction of this Congress, more than three dozen members have announced plans to retire or seek another office when this term ends in 2024. More are likely to follow after the holidays. Many share the exasperation of retiring Representative Dan Kildee, Democrat from Michigan, who said this session has been the most unsatisfying period in my time in Congress because of the absolute chaos and the lack of any serious commitment to effective governance. A HuffPost analysis bore that out, finding that Congress is on pace to pass fewer pieces of legislation in this term than in any term since 1932. Departing members range from Representative Earl Blumenauer, Democrat from Oregon with 27 years of experience, to Representative Victoria Spartz, Republican from Indiana, who has held her seat for a mere 25 months, said Douglas Hay in CNN.com. Their message is clear. Take this job and shove it. Spartz called Congress a circus, an apt description of the House Republican majority's clownish behavior, said Juan Williams in The Hill. The right-wing Freedom Caucus has forced two embarrassing marathon speaker votes, first to install Kevin McCarthy, then to find his replacement, and has derailed every realistic spending package. As retiring Republican Ken Buck of Colorado said, there are some Trump people that got elected to Congress that are just baffling. They just don't belong in Congress. It's only likely to get worse next year when House Republicans will be forced to run for re-election while possibly supporting a convicted felon at the head of the GOP ticket. With sane adults leaving, Congress will be dominated by the nihilist and narcissist who can't even keep the government running, said Mark Z. Baraback in the Los Angeles Times. No wonder Congress's approval rating has sunk to a cringeworthy low of 13%. This exodus could complicate elections next year when Democrats' Senate majority and Republicans' House advantage are both vulnerable, said Jonathan Martin in Politico. But the coming brain drain will have more serious implications. As Representative Brendan Boyle, Democrat from Pennsylvania, observed, it's exactly the wrong people who are wanting to leave. Their departure will only serve to consign Congress's fate to the performance artists, like Republicans Marjorie Taylor Greene of Georgia and Matt Gaetz of Florida, who have no business being there at all. And a couple of short notes. The U.S. is producing more crude oil than at any time in its history. At 13.2 million barrels a day, the current output is above the 10.9 million barrels when President Biden took office in 2020, and the pre-pandemic peak of 13.1 million under former President Trump. The U.S. is now the world's largest producer of crude oil, followed by Russia and Saudi Arabia. It now costs an American family $119.27 to buy the same goods and services that could be bought with $100 pre-pandemic, according to an analysis of inflation data. Since 2020, prices have climbed as much as they did in the full decade before COVID. The world's richest 1% of people are responsible for the same amount of carbon emissions as the 5 billion people in the poorest 66%, according to a new Oxfam report. And we'll finish today's show with a quote from mindfulness guru Jon Kabat-Zinn, who says, "You can't stop the waves, but you can learn how to surf." And with that, we have run out of time for today's episode of the week. We hope you have enjoyed it. Be sure to listen again next time. This is Fred Woodward for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The week is available as a podcast on our website, ncreadingservice.org. For more information, or if you have comments or questions, please give us a call, 919-832-5138. And thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.